sensitive to stimuli, or even sometimes without provocation. So it's very much like epilepsy. So I regard pain as a peripheral representation of epilepsy. That's how I reckon is an easy way of working out why anticonvulsants have an effect on chronic neuropathic pain.
Okay, thanks. Someone said, do you think that menopause, I'm now 49, will mean the dyspareunia will stop? If it would it be worth having a hysterectomy to speed up menopause? So is there any issues when you have, after menopause, there's pain?
I think it's a very, that's a very good question, because it just covers a whole multitude of problems that women have to go through when they go through the menopause. It's not just an endocrine, a hormonal problem, but it's also physical, psychological, social, sexual. In terms of vulval pain, one of the things that we find useful in our clinical practice is to treat the vaginal mucosa with topical estrogens to try and replace that loss of that hormone in menopausal women. I do think that surgery, as a rule, this is just my basic philosophy, surgery is never really the answer to people's problems, because if it's done for pain, you may take away the offending organ, but you're still left with the nerves in place. So people may have heard of phantom problems, phantom limb problems after amputation. The same thing can happen in the pelvis. So I caution surgery unless there is good other reasons, like fibroids or heavy bleeding, etc., that may make surgery a alternative option.
Okay, thanks. That's interesting what you're saying about phantom pain. Are you going to cover that further in your...
Not so much, because in the short time that I've limited myself to what I think are the sort of really critical areas of pain medicine in terms of vulval pain. So I've really tried to look at what is going to be the broad brush for the majority of our ladies with this awful condition.
Okay. Another question just come in. Do you find that women with vulvodynia are also susceptible to other pain syndromes, such as fibromyalgia, interstitial cystitis, and that once one type of chronic pain gets better, the others do too?
Yes, I think that's a very astute question, and this is one of the reasons why I think the pain clinic, or certainly the way we work in our pain clinic, is good, because we look at the comorbidities, i.e. the other medical problems that the patient may have, and there is no doubt that the list the questioner has given us about the other pain problems, like headaches, fibromyalgia, constipation, and the list just goes on and on, has to be treated as well. And I think the question is quite right. These pains all have a place in the charts. So maybe one day vulvodynia is number one in the charts, and then maybe a week later the bladder pain is number one in the charts. So this is why, during the educational part of our consultation, we do try and say to patients, you will have other problems. And sometimes it's for the first time they realize they have coexisting other problems, because they can't see the connection. So I reckon it's a highly sensitized nervous system, and there are a couple of diagrams in the presentation that would explain that. But that is important, that we treat the whole patient rather than treat a disease, because I think then you miss out on the other pain problems. Please.
Yeah. So we've had someone from outside of the UK who's listening.
Yeah.
He said, she's not sure if you can answer this question, but is it possible for somebody who doesn't live in the UK currently to receive treatment by specialists in the UK, perhaps privately?
Oh, I'm sure that would be no problem, but my only advice is choose your expertise with great care.
Okay. Let's see, we've got somebody else who's picked up on the, I think you mentioned mindfulness earlier about whether when the pain isn't to such a degree that you know, that if it's a certain level, that mindfulness and cognitive therapy might be useful. And someone's asked, what are your views on this type of pain management, on mindfulness and cognitive therapies, and do you use these in the UK?
Yes, we do use them in the UK. It's becoming a little bit more trendy. The point I wanted to make was people's pain will change from hour to hour, day to day, month to month. I think if it's a low-level pain, mindfulness and distraction and all the other psychological strategies are useful. All I'm saying is just be careful not to use it as your sole strategy, because when things get really bad and you have a horrendous flare-up, it may not be enough. So all I'm saying is, yes, it's great for background control, but do have some strategies when things get out of control.
Okay, thanks. We've had several questions specifically relating to treatment types, and to, particularly to, we've had some physio and to creams and things. Somebody said they've heard about amitriptyline as a cream rather than oral medication for helping vulvodynia. Do you use this, and how can this person get hold of it?
Well, that's an interesting question, because one of the things that I wanted to emphasize today is I was aware that most vulvodynia patients are being treated by gynecologists or dermatologists, and you will find that the topical treatments are best done by the dermatologist. For example, I don't use any topical treatments in my hospital other than lidocaine ointment, simply because our drugs and therapeutics committee don't feel I am specialist enough to use those drugs and those routes. So in my hospital, we do not use amitriptyline or gabapentin topically, although there's very good evidence that in those patients who try them, it is effective.
Okay, thanks. Somebody else has asked, do some of these oral drugs for vulval pain have fewer side effects than others, and an anti-inflammatory effect? They've mentioned amitriptyline, nortriptyline, gabapentin, pregabalin. Do these have an anti-inflammatory effect and fewer side effects than some other drugs?
Well, I think I've got to be the question is more complicated than it suggests. For me, anti-inflammatory, in terms of anti-inflammation, we're talking about anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac or ibuprofen or steroids. So strictly speaking, when you talk about an anti-inflammatory, I was actually referring to inflammation in the layman's term. However, drugs like nortriptyline, amitriptyline, or the anticonvulsants like pregabalin and gabapentin have anti-inflammatory effects of a different kind on nerves. What is really fascinating is that there is no way in which you can predict which patient will react positively to which drug and at what dose. So a lot of it is guesswork and the bias of the physician. For example, I prefer amitriptyline, but my dermatology colleagues prefer nortriptyline. So I think there is a little bit of a personal bias here. But I would say, if you're trying these drugs, start on a low dose, go slow, but aim for a long time, because they take 6 to 8 weeks to kick in. And even every time you change a dose, it's another 6 to 8 weeks before you get the full effect. What worries me is patients take these drugs rapidly or too quickly and find the side effects horrific, and therefore compliance becomes poor. So start low and stay low is my philosophy, looking at function as well as improvement in pain.
Okay. Somebody's asked, do you have any experience using Botox as a treatment? Is it effective in controlling pain, vulval pain?
Vulva, if you imagine the vulva, behind the vulva you've got muscles. Now, one of the ways in which you can desensitize the muscle is actually by various strategies which will be covered in the lecture. But essentially, if you can calm the vulva down, that's the nerve side, you've still got to attend to the muscular component. Now, in my hospital, we have two physiotherapists who deal with the pelvic floor, but from a pain point of view and not from an incontinence point of view. And they have been fantastic, because basically these two physiotherapists have really transformed the lives of the women that come under our care, because they attend to the muscular component of vulvodynia. And what is important to remember is we've Botox occasionally, but so far we've never had a need to go to that level. And remember, Botox is a neurotoxin. It's you know, it has a potential danger attached to it. So I think doing simple things as a multidisciplinary approach, you're more likely to get a all-round effect rather than relying just on one therapy.
Okay, we've also had, leading on from that, about physiotherapy. How does physiotherapy actually desensitize nerves? What if there is some inflammation present?
Well, first of all, when you've got pain, let's pretend, for example, you've just had a tense day like I have, waiting for this webcam to work. So I'm getting tensed up in my shoulder girdles, and my upper arm and neck is all very tense because I'm just under stress. Now, if I have a massage later on tonight, and a hot bath, and get somebody to actually massage the knots in the muscle, you can imagine those muscles will relax. The same thing happens in the pelvic girdle muscles. What the physiotherapy does is the massages the trigger points in the muscles that need relaxing. So it's never a weakness in the muscle, it's actually these muscles are straining, they're really hard and taut. And this is why I think physiotherapy has been such a bonus, because it can actually help the muscular component that is causing the pain. The vulvodynia is a nerve problem, but there is also a component of muscle, and that's why I think physiotherapy is an essential co-addition to the treatment.
Okay, thanks. Somebody's also asked about physiotherapy. Can you recommend any good physiotherapists in the south of England, or basically how do you find a good physiotherapist who specializes in vulval issues?
Well, that's a very good question. It took me 10 years to find my two physiotherapists in the Northwest. And in the Northwest, I only know of four. They're really quite difficult, and we're desperately trying to get a network together with very little success, because most of the physiotherapies deal with the pelvic floor in terms of incontinence or as part of obstetrics, but very rarely with pain as the criteria. So they are difficult, and I'm afraid I can only talk of the Northwest region.
Okay, we have actually, I think on the Vulval Pain Society's website, there's a link to the BSSVD website as well, which has the vulval clinics in the UK. So I'm sure if you looked at those, that you'd find some good links there. Someone said, if you diagnose vulvodynia in the early stages, is it more likely to be cured quicker than someone who's had it undiagnosed for a long time?
Oh, I was dreading this question, because it's one of the most difficult questions that I've got to try and answer for my patients. The evidence is that vulvodynia disappearing on its own is less than 15%. This is the best figures I could find. So in other words, 85% of patients will be in a chronic condition. There is no evidence that if something starts recently and you treat it quickly, it goes off. I have patients who've had vulvodynia for 20, 30 years and it's gone off. So I would much rather say that focus, don't look at the time interval or the length of time you've had or the therapies you've undergone. Just regard it as a permanent thing and work out on the strategies from a multidisciplinary approach. The reason why that's important psychologically is that if you don't expect it to go away and it does, it's a bonus. If you expect it to go away and it doesn't, you become frustrated. If you become frustrated, you produce more adrenaline. If you produce more adrenaline, you make your pain worse. So I like to switch it from a half empty to a half full glass attitude.
Okay, thanks. Somebody's asking about pudendal nerve entrapment. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to have, I can't read it very easily. Do I need specific tests to discover if I have this? Do you see much PNI in your clinic?
Okay.
Yeah.
The just to give a little bit of background, because this is can be quite confusing. If you look at the motorway setup in the UK, you have the motorway, which is the major roads, and then you have the A roads, B roads, and C roads. I look at the pudendal nerve as the motorway to the pelvis, and I regard vulvodynia as a problem of the C roads. So what I'm saying is, if you block the pudendal nerve, it may relieve some patients with vulvodynia, generalized vulvodynia. However, if you have nerve entrapment, pudendal nerve entrapment, that's a completely different problem, and it's not the remit of this this presentation. But yes, we do get patients, and the diagnosis is clinical. Patients cannot sit. It's as simple as that, and they have pain down below. So it's a very simple diagnosis, and really these patients need to be referred to the pain centers around the UK that deal with it, London, Bristol, and obviously Manchester.
Okay, thanks. Somebody's asked, what sort of strategies would you recommend for a big flare-up? So if someone's already got a strategy in place, or they're taking certain drugs, but suddenly they get a huge flare-up of pain, what should they do?
Well, I think this is a difficult question without knowing the patient and knowing the background and background therapy. But generally speaking, strategies need to be made before your flare-ups occur, because that's when the mistakes are made. Painkillers, whatever they are, codeine, tramadol, or even more potent ones like fentanyl and morphine, may take the edge off. What we rely on is relying on a background analgesia with one of our anticonvulsants or antidepressants, and having a low index of escalating the dose temporarily during a flare-up. What I would advise is not to have any injections at the time, because there's always a risk of any injection treatments of flaring it up and making it even worse.
Okay, thanks. We've had quite a few people emailing in now to say they're enjoying the questions, but how would you consider doing the presentation or the lecture without the slides? So would you be interested in just sort of talking through what you were going to say, but without your slides at the moment? Yes, hopefully if Sabina, if we do get the slides up, we can sort of put them up as you're speaking, and then once you've finished, we might have time for a few more questions.
Okay, I don't think we're going to have much luck at this end, so I don't mind having a go. And I'll start now, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay, so let's just talk about vulvodynia. It's a vulvar discomfort, often burning, and there is nothing to see. Now, patients will say, look, I can see changes, I can see redness, and they'll swear by this. It does happen. Unfortunately, it's transient. So I say to my patients, take a photograph and take it to your next clinic so that the doctors can understand that if things are happening on a transient basis, then at least there'll be some proof of it. And that is not because you're missing something. That is because the nervous system that controls your blood flow to the area also gets changed in this situation. Now, one of the questions asked about other problems. The most common problems are bladder pain, fibromyalgia, irritable, constipation, endometriosis, headache, and dermatographia, which is when you scratch the skin, you get a whole wheal. So these are the common things that we have that coexist with our patients. Most of our women are between the ages of 18 and 25, but I have patients in their 50s that have started for the first time, and even as late as the 60s. So it isn't always true that it's a young girl's disease. But what is true, these women are, if they are young, are more likely to report difficulty with the first tampon use, and almost 50% will have problems with sexual intercourse. So the impact of vulvodynia is really quite huge on the physical status of the patient, on their partners and families, and on psychosexual aspects of their health care. the difficulty when these patients come to me, they've usually gone and seen so many different people, so many different specialists, including other pain clinics. And there is a process through which, if you've got bad news, you tend to go through different emotions. First of all, you just deny it, and then you become angry, and then you become aggressive, and then you just get depressed about the whole thing, and then you start making rational bargaining to try and resolve it. And finally, you get to a level, sometimes, of acceptance. Now, depending on what state the patient's in, that's kind of some of the difficulties we have within our service. What kind of emotional state are the patients are by the time they get to us? They're usually angry about the delay, they're angry about the delay in diagnosis, or the frustrations of no cure. And we spend, I spend about half an hour to an hour reading the notes before they come in. I read through the questionnaire. And then the patient has an hour with myself, my physiotherapist, and my pelvic pain nurse. And we just allow for the first half an hour, 45 minutes, for the patients just to talk about what matters to them. Most of our patients are well-educated, know a lot about vulvodynia, more than I do. But what they don't have is the ability to assess the evidence of what is going to work and what is not going to work. For example, in the 80s, the oxalate-free diet was very trendy. Now it's not so trendy, so I'm a little bit careful about fashions and fads. Then we have the physiotherapist, who will then do a pelvic evaluation, usually through the vagina. And this is really to assess for tenderness, the trigger points I referred to you, and to try and assess the state of the muscles, especially at the entrance of the vagina, which leads on to difficulties with sexual intercourse. We rarely have to do a detailed vulva examination because of the 50 vulvodynia patients I received last year, 45 were from dermatologists. And I really don't think, as a pain physician, I'm going to see any more in the vulva than these specialists have seen before me. So I'm very selective of what I examine. What I do make sure that using a Q-tip is a cotton wool bud, just assess the vulva for tenderness, just to make sure that I can differentiate between the different kinds of vulvodynia, whether it's just on one side, or whether it's just in the vestibule, or whether it's just around the clitoris, or is it just generalized. So that is the challenge. I very rarely investigate these patients because it's a diagnosis by description. There are very few investigations that will confirm it. MRI scans will not make any difference. Nerve conduction studies are just not worth it because they're so painful and actually don't help. What is different is that you may have a diagnosis of vulvodynia, but each patient is unique because each patient has a different psychological background, different levels of depression, anxiety, loss of self-esteem, or perhaps even a history of psychiatric illness. Their sexual health may be different. They may have different libidos, different difficulties with arousal, difficulties with orgasm, or they may be functionally very different. Some may have to give up work. Some may have a lot of financial problems. Some may have a lot of social interactions with their partners, families, etc. And remember, it doesn't spare you the problem of having other medical problems, surgical problems, and obviously the effects of these. So once we've got this, taken this holistic approach to our patients, we then educate them. I use a whiteboard, I take them through the diagrams, and try and get them to realize that vulvodynia or vulval pain is a nerve damage pain. It's not a good pain. It's not the same pain you get when you break a leg or you have surgery and things are fixed and things are okay. This is a nerve damage pain, and that's why I'd rather stress on a long-term strategy than looking for cures. In terms of treatments, I always say every therapy works sometimes for some people for some of the time. So if somebody says to me, they've tried this new therapy they've got from the United States or from the internet and it works, I don't have a problem. The difficulty I have is when people try these things is differentiating it from the placebo response, just because you think it's working, and whether it will work during the flare-ups. So I keep a very open mind about it. The general measures that we get to get our patients to do, I'm sure, are well known to you. Things like aerobic fitness, sleep hygiene, stress management, modifying your diet to avoid acid food and spices, avoid smoking, minimize your alcohol, careful intake, avoid getting constipated, wear loose clothing, and avoid detergents and perfumes. Those are sort of general things you can pick up for any of the sites. Of the non-drug options, the ones I've listed here, which are important for us, is cold. Cold packs seem to help some women. Physiotherapy, I've already mentioned, and relaxation and distraction is helpful in some patients. We don't have a psychologist attached to our clinic, and we do our own psychology. Very rarely do we find a patient so mentally unwell that they require a psychologist per se or a psychiatrist, because quite often when you explain to the patient the background to the problems, they seem to be able to set their own pacing, goal setting, relaxation training, and looking for alternative ways of relaxing. In terms of the drugs, I do have to say that the opioids, that is the morphine, the fentanyls, the codeines, the tramadols, have a very limited benefit. They may take the edge off, but really there are lots of long-term problems of developing tolerance where you're just taking it like Smarties, or they affect your gut, make you constipated, or affect your hormones. They have an impact on fertility, they have an effect on your immunity, and they affect on your mental status, and in some cases make you itch. So if it does work, great. If it doesn't, it's not a high priority. But in terms of treating vulvodynia per se, there are four things: reduction of the triggers that make it worse, a reduction in pain, treating the pelvic floor by physiotherapy, and psychosexual implications if you can. We've already covered the reduction of triggers by avoiding soaps, using cotton tampons, cotton clothing, etc., etc. But the reduction of pain is what I'd like to concentrate on. First of all, topical lidocaine, either the gel or ointment, if it doesn't burn and it works, you're lucky, because it's brilliant. It doesn't sensitize the skin as much as the other local anesthetics, but it's brilliant when it does work. I prefer the ointment because it sticks rather than the gel, which is watery and falls off. Topical estrogens are useful, especially in that patient the questioner who asked about topical estrogens. Yes, if you're menopausal and if your vaginal mucosa is dry, topical estrogens certainly will help and will reduce your pain. Nortriptyline and amitriptyline are the common tricyclics. Gabapentin and pregabalin are the common anticonvulsants. Use low doses of both, or a combination if you can. So the message is, start low, go slow, but for God's sake, do not stop the drugs abruptly, because when that happens, it's horrendous, because then you get a worse flare-up, or you go cold turkey and things get out of control. So these drugs are not to be chopped and changed every few days or weeks. That needs to be regarded as a long therapy. And patients know when they're better. If they are confident and if they want to wean off, I wean them off very slowly so that if the problem comes back, they've got enough blood in the bloodstream to get back on top again. In terms of the pelvic floor dysfunction, that is the trigger points in the muscle, the physiotherapist will give you exercises to relax the muscle, as opposed to tightening them up, which is what you have to do for incontinence. Internal or external soft tissue massage is just like anything else. If you have your shoulder girdle massage, it's very comforting. The same thing once you break the trigger points can be also very helpful. Using vaginal dilators or trainers are also useful. And most of my patients use this to relax the muscle to allow sexual intercourse. So they are really important issues. In terms of psychosexual ramifications, I think it depends on the patient. If a patient puts sex, hygiene, or sexual health as a priority, then we would pay much import. I think it depends on the individual patient. So far, and I think it's a reflection of how we behave towards sex therapy in the UK, we tend to do our own treatments or education within house. But I would have a very low index of referring these patients on, especially if there was a psychological or marital guidance aspect which is beyond our remit within the pain service. So addressing sexual issues is important, but it's trying to be sensitive about the optimal time to ask. We do take sexual concerns seriously, but we're also sensitive to gender and cultural factors. We also are aware that the partners, the role of the partner is important, either in the result of the problem or as a result of being a therapeutic part of the treatment. Confidentiality is obvious, and I know my own areas of comfort and discomfort. I think I've got to 60 years of age. I'm not particularly fussed about discussing sensitive matters, but I think it really depends on how comfortable the patient feels. We do have a nurse and a physiotherapist in the room, and occasionally the patient asks the members of the team to leave. So we take each individual patient individually. In terms of the invasive techniques, if it's a focal vulvodynia, so it's a vestibule between 5 and 7 o'clock, then local anesthetic and steroids might help, and we do this every 3 or 4 months. It's a straightforward injection, but there are risks, as you can imagine, with chronic use of steroids, making the skin thinner, etc., etc. And as we mentioned earlier, the pudendal nerve is the motorway, so sometimes blocking the pudendal nerve may help some vulvodynia patients. And there are one or other two aspects of invasiveness that only the pain clinic can do, but that is really the tip of the iceberg, and it's a last resort. So in other words, what we've talked about will provide 95% of the strategies, and the really more invasive, which people tend to latch on when they read it on the internet, are the things that are really the roof on a building. If you haven't got good, strong foundations, if you don't go into it realizing the limitations of these kind of strategies, then I think you're doomed to failure. So I like to go through a sequence of events to help patients. If you look at the British Society of Vulvovaginal Diseases guidelines published in 2010, really we do most of it. And I just want to make a point about surgical excision, or vestibulectomy, in other words, cutting out the vulva. If you look at the literature, yes, in some surgeons, the results are very good. But I, as a pain physician, am just nervous about surgeons, because when you cut a piece of body out, the nerves going to that area are still there. So I just feel we are, surgery is something that needs to be considered very carefully and be aware that it is not a cure. So in summary, vulvodynia is a neuropathic pain. It's not a good pain. Secondly, pain and suffering are horrible twins. I always tell my patients, I have no drug therapy for suffering. Suffering is something that is really difficult, and listening and trying to diffuse flare-ups are the only thing. I would say to my patients, don't concentrate on pain, concentrate on your function. Don't let your life go by. It doesn't really matter what age you are. For the young girl, they've got different requirements than for somebody who's married and wants to have a child, or somebody about to deliver a child, or somebody who's reaching menopause. So each woman is different, but they need to concentrate on function as far as they can. And also have realistic expectations. In other words, don't go for a cure, because if you go for a cure, statistically, you're going to be disappointed. Go for a quality of life improvement. And then if you get a cure, that's a bonus. And finally, when I get these patients and some of them are very angry, just remember, if you've got a good doctor or a specialist, there is a healthy therapeutic alliance between you, your doctor, and whatever that treatment is. And that alliance is important. And remember, doctors are human beings as well. And it's, as I said to you earlier, I don't have any treatment for suffering. But we have to look at the long-term marathon rather than the 100-meter dash, and that's what I wish to say tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Winston. Thank you for doing that without your slides. I wonder if there's still time to take a few more questions, and I wonder,
yes, sure.
Winston, if you're okay going on just to sort of 5 minutes,
yes,
past eight,
no,
or
no,
something,
no problem.
So
yeah,
as we had a few problems at the beginning. So I've got a lot of questions here already. Do you continue to send them in if you'd like? There are some here that are quite similar, so we can probably cover them together. So there's several questions here about sort of complementary treatments for pain, including acupuncture and chiropractic and things like that. What are your views on those as therapies for pain?
Like everything in life, if somebody says to me, I've had a chiropractic session and my pain's reduced, I would have no problems with that. The trouble is, when you go for evidence, there is very little literature. For example, the BSBVD guidelines says there's no place for acupuncture, but I do have patients who have acupressure, acupuncture with good effect. So the answer is, give it a go, and if it hasn't worked after a few sessions, cut your losses.
Okay. We've had a few questions about other painkillers that aren't typically used, like ketamine, MDMA, other types of drugs like that. Have you got any views on those? Or?
Yes, I think ketamine on paper is a very good medication for neuropathic pain. The trouble is that it comes with a side effect profile that is not suitable for every patient, and therefore I try and shy away from it because it has implications for some people's work. Some people will not employ them if they're on ketamine. Some people working in high-risk industry will not be allowed to use them. So yes, ketamine, and I'm sure a lot of other agents will work some of the time for some of the people in somewhere in the world. So I think the answer is try it, and if it's a side effect profile and its cost is not prohibitive, good luck.
Thank you. I've got a question. I'm just going to mention your name. It's Debbie, because you've asked several times, could I ask, put a question to Dr. DeMello about your daughter or someone who's a lot younger, and I can't actually, for some reason, I haven't got your original question that you sent through, so if you want to send that again. But Winston, I wonder if you want to say something about treating women or girls, you know, who are much younger, whether you've got,
okay,
any experience with that.
I think this is a really unknown problem. I'm convinced that vulvodynia is occurring earlier than we think. Now, I am aware that in the United States, where they have adolescent gynecologists, these specialists are picking this problem up. In the UK, we are still not that sophisticated. So my question really, to the questioner, is what do we do about it? Because I work in an adult clinic, and therefore, by definition, I do not see patients below the age of 16, although I do see the occasional child for obvious reasons, because the pain services in the UK are not that good for chronic pain for children. But I think it's an interesting thing, and I would suggest that if the questioner feels that her daughter has vulvodynia, for example, vulval pain, I think an appropriate referral to a sympathetic gynecologist in the first place must take place, because there are other possibilities for the condition. In other words, there is a differential diagnosis, and I would be loath to take the patient on without a clear check from a gynecologist, or if it's a skin-related problem, a clear bill, not a clear bill, but at least some acknowledgement by a specialist dermatologist. I'm more than aware that my expertise is in pain medicine and not in those areas, but I do think there are lots of girls out there with the problem.
Okay, thanks. Debbie's actually sent in her question now. Actually, it's quite a specialist question, Debbie, that relates to your daughter's case, so I'm not sure we can really go into it in detail, but really, sort of Debbie's asking about, I think, whether if someone's, if her daughter, for instance, has been on drugs like amitriptyline for a certain amount of time and they sort of stop working or the pain breaks through or you get urethral pain, what to do then? And also that, is there a link really with vulvodynia pain and hormonal changes during periods and how should sort of meds be adjusted around that?
I feel very, I feel rather, I just want to be cautious about not making any comments on this case because it's difficult.
It's a personal case and I don't think we can go into it, but I mean, just generally to talk about
rule,
perhaps the cycle. But
as a general rule, I think there's no question that periods, especially if you've got premenstrual syndrome where you pile on weight before a period and get very tense, yes, it will make your pain worse. There's no question about that. Stress does make a difference, and the organs in the pelvis talk to one another. So yes, it's no different from an adult.
Okay. Somebody else has asked about TENS machines for pain management. Is that something you've ever used?
We don't use TENS in our clinic because basically by the time they come to us, they've tried TENS.
Yes.
So I don't see people's successes. So I have no personal experience of TENS for vulvodynia, but I'm aware of patients who swear by them.
Okay, thanks. Somebody else asking about experimental treatments or drugs, you know, is there any research going on into new treatments for pain, not just vulvodynia but other chronic pain? Someone's mentioned cannabis as well.
Yes, I mean I think what our listeners must realize that the regulations now for drugs are so strict that that these are highly restricted. Cannabis was fashionable 4 or 5 years ago. We were really hoping it would work. It's been a disappointment. So there is nothing in terms of what's new out there that's going to hit us very quickly. I think that the whole research process is now being slowed down by bureaucracy and by healthcare checks because governments and the European Union and the FDA in America have got such strict rules. So I'm afraid there is nothing in the pipeline that's going to happen that's going to really make a big difference. We've just got to wait and see.
Okay. Somebody's asked, how does a layperson know if it's best to see a gynecologist, a dermatologist, a pain specialist, or whoever, you know, who is the best, how do you know who to be referred to or where to go?
Well, I think that's one of the problems about the lottery, about how these patients get referred. Because, for example, the young girl that you were referring to, if she presents with bladder problems or urethral problems, she'll go to the urologist. I think this is the trouble. So I always educate the GPs and say, please take a step back and start looking at the pelvis as a whole. And if you think you're running out of options, you've seen the gynecologist, you've seen the urologist, negative urine specimens, negative for candida and thrush, just take one step back and listen to the patient. And I'm afraid, I think it's people, societies like the Vulval Pain Society, that needs to educate doctors that our patients don't suffer.
Okay, thanks. Someone's asking about episiotomy scars and whether you see a lot of women who have vulval pain after they've given birth and how you treat
yes.
that.
The episiotomy, which is a cut made to the usually at 7 o'clock or 5 o'clock to allow the baby to come through, is occasionally will become a difficult scar pain. Just remember that any surgery, there is a risk of getting pain after surgery, and it depends on which area. And the pelvic area, especially the perineum, is prone to, because it's very rich in blood and very rich in nerves, is prone to pain conditions. Yes, we do have patients with episiotomy scars, which are very painful. The first thing I will say is, please do not have it excised without first trying to desensitize the area with lidocaine ointment or some of the medication and have the muscle stretched, and then only consider having the scar taken out, because what I dread is having the episiotomy scar taken out, and it looks really nice in terms of physical appearance, but then you've got a worse pain than you started off with because you've basically cut through a raw area. So that's what I would recommend. Yes, and we do have several patients post episiotomy pain doing really well without surgery.
Thanks. Somebody else asking, do you think it's possible to switch off chronic pain for good, or is someone who's got chronic pain likely to be in remission but then still have to, you know, have episodes of it? And do you have a sort of success rate at your clinic?
Well, one of the things that I guess I've not managed to get across is there is no such thing as success in such a huge variety of presentations and comorbidities. Yes, we do have some patients who go on and do well, but I'm not sure how I define success. For example, the young girl that came to see me at 17 as unable to have intercourse is now able to have intercourse and is having her first baby. For me, that is success. Now, in terms of if you were looking at pain alone, then I'm afraid we don't have any successes. So I always look at function rather than pain, because there's a 15% chance that the pain will go away just by Mother Nature. So in other words, if I have all my patients, 15% will get better no matter what I do. So I have to be very, very honest and say success is something I find very difficult to define, because I define success or outcome with my individual patient. Is it to get pregnant? Is it to have a maintain a job? Is it to resume sexual intercourse? So everything is different. So the outcome measure must be realistic and attainable. The pain, if it disappears, is a bonus.
Okay, and someone's asked, given that you say that nerve damage causes vulvodynia, do we have to take drugs such as antidepressants and anticonvulsants for life, or do you think you can just take them for a certain period of time and then sort of fixes the problem?
That's a very good question. I think that's a really good question. What I do is I do not give any of my patients a time frame. I just say, start low, go slow, find a level that suits you. If things are quiet and there are less flare-ups, or their pain scores, say for example, run about 8 or 9 out of 10 and are now hovering at 3 to 4 out of 10, and they're consistent. And usually my patients tell me when they want to come off the medication. They say, Doc, can I have a go at coming down? So, for example, say if a patient's on 40 milligrams of nortriptyline every night, I say, right, okay, let's go down to 30 and leave it for a couple of months. And then at 30, everything's fine, go down to 20. The reason for doing it slowly is that if the pain comes back with vengeance, you can just step up the dose and hopefully you'll overcome that flare-up. If you stop too quickly and you'll go from 40 to zero in the space of a month, and then just unlucky enough, the next month you have a flare-up, it's going to be 6 to 8 weeks for the drugs to get in your system to catch up. So I'm cautious. Yes, and I do have patients who are drug-free, having been on either amitriptyline or nortriptyline or gabapentin or pregabalin, and are now drug-free. But I take each individual patient, so I don't make the same rules for everyone.
Okay. Somebody's asked, it's two questions combined here. Really. One person's asked, would it surprise you if gabapentin and amitriptyline together don't work? And somebody else has asked, you know, do you recommend a multidisciplinary approach, and do you think you should try one thing at a time, or basically go for lots of things at once?
Okay, let's ask gabapentin. The second question is, I really worry about people trying things which I'm not aware of. In other words, I'm quite happy for patients to try several things within my clinic. So we know what the patient's up to. What is my nightmare scenario is I'm trying to do something while a chiropractor is doing something else and somebody else is doing something else, and by the time we know, I don't know what is effective and what is causing problems. So I make my patients concentrate on what is within the pain service, only just to make sure that we don't make mistakes and we don't throw the baby with the bathwater.
Okay, thanks. So we'll just take a couple more questions because it's 8:05 now. So several people have asked and made reference, you spoke about nerve damage in your presentation and wanting to sort of know exactly what you mean by nerve damage, and how do we know when nerves are damaged, and how do we fix sort of damaged nerves?
Well, first of all, you cannot fix fixed damaged nerves. The bottom line, and that is why I keep going on about the importance of separating nociceptive pain, which is good pain, the pain that you get when you break a leg, from neuropathic pain, of which vulvodynia is one aspect of it. And the injections with steroids, all they do is try and put some masking tape, like when you get a raw wire and you put black masking tape. That's all it does. It just reduces the irritability of the nerve. So there is no such thing as recovery from damaged nerves. But what you can do is to calm the sensitivity of the nerves by using local anesthetic gels, ointments, by using antidepressants, anticonvulsants, because they reduce the traffic of pain both at spinal cord and at the brain. That is why if I had a pound for every time I had to explain this to patients who have not been told that actually vulvodynia is a nerve problem as opposed to nociceptive pain, which is a more classical pain approach. And I think that is just education, and that is why you will not be surprised. These patients have tried non-steroidals, tried codeines, tramadols with no benefit. So it's a completely different set of pain and a different set of approaches.
Okay, so thank you very much. So just one more, just one last question before we sum up. Somebody's asking, actually two people have asked, is it possible to see you privately, or rather if people want from other parts of the country that don't live in your local catchment area, if your clinic, if people wanted to see you privately, could they do that?
Yes, they can, but there's an even easier way. They can get their GP to refer me to the NHS. I get patients from all over the country.
Okay, great. That's good to know. Okay, well, I think we'll leave it there because it's 7 minutes past 8. And thank you ever so much for giving us your time today. And I'm sorry we've had technical problems and we couldn't see your slides, but I'm sure everyone will agree that it was great to hear what you had to say anyway without the slides and to answer the questions. So thank you ever so much for your time.
Well, thank you to the Vulval Pain Society for, I think, publicizing this important problem. And I wish all the listeners all the very best.
Thank you very much.